Buonasera Rudy Ghede.
Buonasera.
Rudy Ghede o Rudy Ghede?
Per me è Guede.
Io devo chiamarla Guede.
Guede, sì. Guede, Rudy Ghede. Mi ritrovo in Guede.
Perfetto.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, former New York City prosecutor and retired FBI profiler, current writer and producer on CBS's Criminal Minds, as well as co-creator and co-executive producer of CBS's The Case of JonBenet Ramsey. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, analyst, advocate, and activist, and director and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and also co-creator and co-producer of CBS's The Case of JonBenet Ramsey.
And buongiorno, mi chiami Lisa Zambetti. I am the direttore di casting of Criminal Minds, and Jim Clemente is my colleague. I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes.
So do you actually speak Italian?
Niente. No, not really, no. My grandparents were Italian. They spoke Bergamasque, which is a very strange kind of Italian. So I have that in my ear. My father speaks as much Italian as, you know, he could. He considers himself speaking the level of a four-year-old, but I disagree. I think he's quite fluent.
But you can get by, or should we put subtitles on the pod? That's
what I was...
Right. Maybe
it sounded beautiful, bellissimo. Yes.
It is a beautiful language. I know my grandmother used to speak it when I was a kid, and I could understand it for a while. But when you don't speak it or hear it,
you
for
can understand
many,
certain
many
things.
Years.
Yeah. And this is something I do want to get to as we discuss this case, this issue of translating from Italian back to, you know, English back and forth. But, you know, my grandmother would say Lazzarona. That's her way of saying, get out of bed, you're sleeping in too late, you know, but that literally doesn't translate to that. Mm-hmm. So I think it's kind of a big question in this case where so many people are quoted in and out of context.
Well, it's hugely relevant because there was a lot of back and forth. And of course, some of the legal proceedings, you know, where there isn't a substitute or parallel word to translate. And it can be very confusing for everybody. And is some of it intentional too? You know, that it's a little bit misleading where lots of phrases are used that's kind of old school, traditional Italian that doesn't translate anymore.
And not just sort of generalizations, I guess, but the structure of the language itself, how they speak, how they form their sentences, and the fact that they tend to be more flowery and effusive about what they're saying as opposed to precise and accurate, which we are used to in a court of law. Like the way something is said and how it is phrased and how it is articulated is very important in our court system. And when I read the transcripts from this trial and when I read the interviews and the interrogations that were done, it seems to be so amorphous to me.
And ambiguous, and it's very difficult to understand.
Because the words can be interpreted in many different ways.
And romanticized to some degree. Yeah. And of course, for our listeners, we're talking about the case of Meredith Kircher.
Thank you, Laura. I meant we should probably say that. Yeah.
We've gotten into the Italian language because Lisa so beautifully introed us. Yes. But, you know, the language is a very important point. And certainly with this particular podcast, we're going to talk about Rudy Guede's interview, which was his first interview and occurred on January the 22nd, 2016, and it was from prison. He was 29 years old at the beginning of this year, and we want to talk about it specifically, and this is subtitled too. So, yes. You know, Lisa just said to Jim C and I when we first started talking about it, just somebody has kindly interpreted and translated, and there are subtitles that you can find online if you Google Rudy Guede's interview with Franca Liassini, and it's part of the story Maledet, but some of it doesn't translate quite as perfectly. So that's why we sort of started off talking about language and translation.
And even the title, as you said in Italian, Story Maledet, it means cursed stories. And I think if we look at just how this interview of Rudy Guede is set, It's done very theatrically. Mm-hmm. It's done in a way that to make you believe that they're in somebody's living room in a wonderfully decorated place. They pull back at times to reveal that they're sort of in a sewing room of sorts, and it could be a prison job. I'm not sure. It could be a completely set stage.
It looks completely like fantasy land to me.
I mean, they say that it's pre-taped. It's a multi-camera interview from Viterbo prison. That's how they describe it.
But they certainly put up all sorts of lighting. You could see the stage lighting that was set up really high along the walls, and dramatic settings and so forth, shadowing here and there. And Rudy Guede is dressed and, you know, very nicely dressed, and he has nice current eyeglasses on and very, you know, fashionable.
It's a beautiful Italian wool or a cashmere sweater on. Yeah. And
gray and with a white shirt. Mm-hmm. And actually his the way that he presents is in stark contrast to how he was arrested and what he looked like.
Right.
And as you said, Jim, so he has got the very fashionable glasses, and his hair is very well coiffed, and a small sort of goatee beard versus, or in contrast to what he looked like when he was arrested in Germany.
Because his behavior at that time, before he murdered Meredith Kircher, was he was kind of itinerant. He basically flopped at different friends' houses and was homeless and broke into places and slept overnight there and ate their food and so forth. And so there's a lot of disorganized behavior beforehand.
Kind of itinerant, you know, individual who, even by his own admission, would just go missing for, you know, large amounts of time with no real reason for why he just disappears off the planet.
But if you listen to this interview, you'll see him try to very carefully craft his image and stay away from things and that are nasty or not nice or criminal. And he will also do his best to characterize himself. At the time of this murder, and we won't call it an incident like they did or a tragic story like they did on this interview, we'll call it what it is, the sexual assault and murder of Meredith Kircher, that he claims he was a boy. He was 20 years old. He was not a boy. He was a man. And the fact that he's trying to convince listeners and viewers that he was just a boy, and that accounts for his actions that night.
And he was panicked and confused and just so young that anyone in that situation would have behaved in the same way. That's how it sort of comes across. But he was a man, and I think that is a very important context and start point. And those who might be interested in just looking at his appearance, there's an article by The Express that just shows the two pictures of him when he was first arrested, and then you can see how he presents and what he looks like on this particular interview.
And as you have said a number of times, a picture paints 1,000 words, but being there paints 1,000,000 words. I think that if you actually look at his pictures, you'll see a stark difference. But I think if you actually experienced him back in the days of when he murdered Meredith Kircher and today, you're going to see a stark contrast, although I don't believe that is any kind of complete transformation, but we'll get into that as we go on to this.
His language, you know, his use of Italian, and, you know, admittedly, I can get by with little bits of saying thank you and ordering, but a couple of people have said to me that his Italian is actually quite polished in this interview. Which, again, just the language that he's using and the way that he's presenting. And there's certainly a few points where I see leakage, which we'll talk about, where certain things, what I would call the residue of the old him, contrasting, you know, starkly with sort of the new him. But we'll point that out as we sort of go through.
This is the first official public interview he's given, although he has been obviously testified many times and has been deposed and all this before
this
now.
This is since his conviction. Mm-hmm. So the first time he's spoken out at the beginning of this year. Yes, which I find an interesting thing. We talked about it with Oscar Pistorius of why would he get a platform when ITV interviewed him just before being sentenced. And here again, you know, we see somebody who's still in the prison system, but for some reason there is a lot of interest in interviewing him. Apparently, he turned down lots of other interviews and chose her specifically, Franca Liassoni, to be interviewed by. I don't know if any money changed hands, but it certainly gives him a platform to launch his, certainly his account, but his retrial from. And I think there's no coincidence that he sets up his Facebook page and Twitter account just before the interview goes live.
Yeah, and I think that if you look at her whole demeanor in this interview, it's very clear that she is setting the stage that he is somebody that was the victim of circumstances, that he doesn't have any real culpability here. He was just a young kid and got caught up in something, and he was almost completely innocent of doing anything wrong at all. She takes what would be seen in American journalism as a very one-sided approach to this, even though at times she raises questions about his behavior and his inconsistencies and so forth. He perpetuates those inconsistencies, and she never calls him on it.
Yeah, it's kind of a softball interview in a way. She reminds me a little bit of Larry King, how he would kind of try to act like he was, you know, giving you the hard, you know, hard questions, but really it was kind of softened up. Mm-hmm. And she does a lot of smiling to him, a lot of kind of I understand you.
Lot of major preambles to asking questions, and all those preambles set up his innocence, set up the fact that he was taken advantage of, set up the fact that other people did the bad things and he just was a victim of circumstances. And it's just, to me, it's, well, especially in light of the fact that there's actually a determinative conclusion to the case against Amanda Knox and Rafaela Solicito, it just really stands out as sort of reprehensible behavior. They start out trying to say that this is dedicated to Meredith Kircher.
Meredith.
Yeah, take us back, Laura. Tell us how it starts.
And I think that start point is interesting. I'm just reading my notes on it where I, you know, say right from the start that the way it's set up is a problem. Just the things that you both said, I completely agree with, but I think it's also interesting that they describe Meredith, you know, as being sort of a gentle beauty. But in direct contrast, they describe Amanda Knox as sort of an explosive sexual and, you know, sensuality about her. This bewitching and restless girl from Seattle, and, you know, versus Meredith Kircher, who's from this historic city of Southwark in London, and the way it's kind of romanticised. So I think right from the start, it's highly stylized with piano music in the background, and then saying that this is a tribute to Meredith and her family. And then there's this gear change and transition into Guede and Rudy Guede. And obviously that is the focus point of this interview. It's very clear that that's what it's going to be about. And that actually sat really uncomfortably with me. I found it quite insulting for them to start out saying that it's about Meredith and then very quickly transition into talking about him, saying that he's the only person who took the blame for this tragedy. And then all the things that you both just said of, you know, taking us on this journey to a faraway land where this young little, you know, this little boy in his shorts, you know, was in the Ivory Coast and he's ripped from the bosom of his mother. Ugh. Very emotive sort of language.
Oh, yeah, I was definitely moved by that. And there's no doubt about it. And I think that those two things can be true, that he had a terrible, you know, tragic...
Could also be just as false as his story about what happened on the night he killed Meredith Kircher.
No, what I mean is it can still be true that he was ripped out of his mother's arms and had this sort of terrible traumatic upbringing, and he could still be a murderer. Absolutely.
Right. But what I'm saying is he may not have had a terrible upbringing. He may not have actually been ripped from the arms of his mother. He may have killed his mother. He may have run away from his mother. There are many different possibilities. I would not believe his rendition of events. Everything that comes after it is all to support his ego and to build an image that is squeaky clean and wonderful and all that.
Sure, but I think it has been documented that he was parted from his mother.
But you don't know how that.
Yes.
I'm sure. They don't describe.
They don't document.
Yeah, they don't document how.
Well, not here. It's not documented here.
No,
but
no,
I mean, I think
but what I'm saying is, it's not possible to document what the circumstances were, or how traumatic or untraumatic it was for him. It may not have had any trauma at all or any resultant trauma on him, because he may have been completely detached from her from the beginning.
It's a good point. I mean, children can be very, very resilient. And, you know, we don't know the detail and the way that he describes it. And, you know, I kind of agree with Jim and you as well, Lisa, at the same time. But just the way that he describes it, you know, there's a lot of detail being omitted. And when she says, tell us what happened that day that should never have happened to a child that left an imprint on the fate of your life.
Yes.
You know that...
Don't you feel like you're being manipulated by that sentence?
You're being led down a certain pathway. And his version is that, you know, his father just appears on the scene. He'd never met his father, but his father rips him from his mother and takes him to Italy. And it was a real shock to be exiled to Italy. And then you have the drama and you've got the violin music in the background. And that his father, you know, he was very pleased to be with his father, but he had lots of women and partners, etc. But he was still very pleased to be with his father, but he was left alone a lot and he felt like he was a burden all the time and that he was a latchkey kid and had to be self-reliant. And the violin still playing in the background.
And the poor kid who had to come home and he would stay out till 6 p.m. because nobody was actually expecting him home before that. That's so horrible. I'm sorry, I don't feel any horror or shame.
I do. I think that can still all be true.
It could be true, but just accept the fact that it may be the lie.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, one thing that I did feel manipulated about was when the signora says, now, Rudy, when you first told me the story, you were crying. but right now you seem, you know, to me that tells me there's some coaching going on. And if there's a pre-interview to an interview, that's
I mean, I did feel a little bit, you know, I definitely felt like I was being manipulated without a shadow of a doubt. And, you know, I took the cues not just from what he was saying, but from the music and the drama.
Yeah,
they
that
were
was like Schindler, by the way, that's like Schindler's List music that they have throughout the entire.
Really?
Yeah.
Right. And it's for a purpose. Mm-hmm. But I do think, you know, emotionally, you know, when children are neglected, of course, it does have an impact. So I have no doubt that did play into why he was had an itinerant and kind of transient lifestyle and why he didn't fit in anywhere.
But we've both seen cases where children at that age are full-blown, you know, killers, psychopaths, if they could be diagnosed under the age of 18 as psychopaths. It doesn't mean just because he was separated from his mother, it doesn't mean that caused that. He could have been that way already. And I certainly feel for children who are abused and taken advantage of and not loved and not nurtured. But I also know that not loving a child does not cause them to rape and murder.
Of course not.
Nor does abuse. And as we've said before, there's a big, you know, there's a lot of psychosocial, you know, behavioral, there's so many other variables that go on. But the way that it's being described, you know, I certainly had a little bit of sympathy, but I feel that he was given a lot of opportunities too.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, much more so than
we'll
many other
them.
Children
yeah.
that I've seen who have been abused sexually or physically, emotionally, psychologically. And, you know, he talks about various key people in his life, which, as you know, Jim C., you know, when you have people who invest in you, it can change the whole course of your life too. And he had numerous people adopted emotionally by one of his teachers who sort of spent quite a bit of time with him and took him home, made sure he got home and so that he wasn't fending for himself. And, you know, she played a key part in his life. And he talks about the fact that he had a number of other friends as well within the school that he spent time with. And he kind of enjoyed, you know, boy relationships with other boys in his class. But then he was adopted by a wealthy family, the Caporali family. So he's given another big chance here. And he enjoyed basketball and he says he could have been a basketball champion. And then you get another bit of drama, but my life took a dramatic turn. And then comes the sad violin music and a picture of the prison. And I guess, you know, part of what I was building to was just the fact that, you know, the whole time he's claiming victimhood and that's the red alarm and the red, you know, sort of the warning sign for me that somebody who's continuously claiming victimhood and does not take responsibility for any of their behaviour or their actions. And I don't see in this part of the first part of the interview any responsibility taking. I see much more about him saying, you know, he was invited into the Caporali family. He was given a chance. They sponsored on the basketball scene. He was very talented in terms of playing basketball. They're a very well-known family. And he had every opportunity to thrive and to be part of something. When she asks why did the Dolce Vita come to an end, he sort of says, well, I caused the manga because I was roaming when I should have been in school and I didn't make good grades. And he just sort of made it very casual and sort of brushed it off rather than actually there were a lot of things that I did I'm not proud of, and I played a part in all of this, of what happened.
Yeah, he minimized it, definitely.
Complete minimization and distancing from it. And, you know, when talking about why the fostering came to an end, his version was that, well, he turned 18 and ergo it came to an end. But that's not what the families say. So again, it goes back to Jim C's point, which is what we always look to do, is corroborating everything, because this is just one version of events. It's not necessarily the truthful version of what happened.
Right. Well, this sounds like a good time to take a break to hear a word from our sponsors.
Well, Jim, our listeners asked for it and they got it.
Well, we now have Real Crime Profile swag, and it's on Zazzle.
That's
right. You can all get it.
You can go to Zazzle.com and search for Real Crime Profile, and our store should pop right up. You know what? I had so much fun designing these T-shirts and sweatshirts and mugs, Jim, because your artwork looks great on anything.
Well, thanks. I really love how it looks. You did a great job. And what's really cool is that a percentage of the proceeds of every sale of Real Crime Profile swag on Zazzle will go to charities like Paladin, Male Survivor, and CASA.
And CASA, which is for corner-pointed special advocates for children. So CASA of Los Angeles.
Great. Mm-hmm.
So have fun, guys. Go on the site. You can get your T-shirt, your coffee cup. There's even a watch. That looked really good.
Yeah. There's a whole bunch of watches and different size mugs and different size T-shirts and sweatshirts and different designs.
And if you want us to create anything else, you know, I can go in and create it for you. Somebody asked for bumper stickers, so I'll make a bumper sticker. So we had a great time designing it, and I think we're going to be doing some good for a lot of charities that are close to our hearts. So we hope you check it out.
And we hope they're close to your hearts, too.
That's right.
Rudy, perché hai fuggito?
Sono fuggito perché avevo paura che non mi avrebbero creduto.
And now we're back from the break. And back into the case.
What did you think about it, Jim C?
Well, I mean, at what point exactly? What do you mean? Which point?
Well, he's given an opportunity in terms of, you know, he's...
The foster family.
He's got a teacher who's invested in him. He's got friends who are invested in him. He's adopted by this wealthy, well-known and well-to-do family who want to invest in his basketball. Mm-hmm. And yet, each time he's been given investment and opportunity and nurturing and that... It all seems to keep going wrong, yet he takes no responsibility for that
right.
part.
And I think that he's also described, I think we mentioned this earlier, that he's described as somebody who would hold conversations with himself or talk to people that weren't there. He was itinerant, you know, I mean, we call him homeless here, kind of a vagrant, petty crimes, breaking and entering, trespassing, burglary, petty thievery. These kinds of things could be an indication of some level of mental illness, a mental disorder that kept him from, participating in society the way that we would think he would, especially given the benefit of a wealthy benefactor and people who did care about him. So there's some indicators now. He was never diagnosed, so I don't know, but
I mean, even personality disorder, you know, some of these things mm-hmm. that people aren't necessarily always tested for,
right. But clearly, at least for this interview, it's a fairly extensive interview, he's been cleaned up and polished up, and he's very articulate. He definitely has his story down, even though and we'll talk about this in detail later on, but even though when you get down to brass tacks, you can tell when he's being evasive or when he's trying to point the finger at somebody else or when he's doing things that show that he's not committed to what the words that are coming out of his mouth. He gets vague, he gets general, but he's very articulate. So you can norm him during this conversation and see the changes in that behavior.
And sometimes there's wild gesticulating and a lack of words in some very clear places. Mm. I've kind of thought the transition from when she's talking about his childhood and he's all, you know, sort of claiming the victimhood. And then there's this section where she talks about him and girlfriends, and he actually becomes quite bashful and coy, when she says, you know, you were catching girls. She used this phrase, you know, you caught girls. And he kind of giggles and kind of nervously sort of smiles. And he says, yes, you know, I had a girlfriend in Milan and I had a job as a bartender there, but I lost the job. And again, I wonder what the narrative is there. I lost the job. Well, what really happened?
Right. But also she's basically flirting with him and he's flirting with her. I mean, they're being very inappropriate, really. They're talking about a brutal murder, which he was convicted of, by the way. And yet she's treating him like this, oh, yeah, you know, you're pretty hot.
A bit
you're...
of a Jack the Lad. And then he says he loses his job. We don't know how or why. I'm sure there's a story there. Mm-hmm. But he returns to Perugia and she says, oh, and you lost your girlfriend too. And then you see this little leakage moment of sort of cockiness where he said, no, I lost her because I returned to Perugia. Ergo, it's my decision. And I was the one who walked away from the relationship, not the other way around. There's no coyness or bashfulness there. It's actually, you know, there's this kind of smirk de triomphe almost that he's kind of asserting himself in it. And I see a very different side to him just at that little point.
Yeah.
And then he's talking about, or she mentions the fact he's given another opportunity, that the Tiberi family, the teacher who sort of adopted him, gives him another opportunity by finding him a job. And I know that there are lots of other, you know, children and young people who don't keep getting these opportunities afforded to them, but yet he's still trying to claim sort of victimhood. He is, but she also then says, and there's a slight change of gear, and it's still relatively soft, but she says, you know, I have to raise some issues around your attitude and actions, you know, that sometimes you would just disappear. And he says, oh, well, I 100% agree with that. You know, I did just disappear. And then she says to him, so these are like blackouts. This is you trying to escape from yourself. You know, you're trying to run from yourself. And she's putting all these words
right,
into his mouth.
Right, that's what I'm saying. She's leading him in such a way that it's just inappropriate.
But can I just backtrack a little bit? I mean, I know that this is all being spun by her and it's more he's being presented like the artful dodger and there's something, you know, romantic that she's trying to present him as. But if you do think back, if you do take this as true, because I've read this in other accounts of his, that, you know, he was a kid who had almost zero adult supervision, right? So he's like, you know, staying at everybody's houses. He's probably, you know, having dinner here, breakfast there. He's on his own a lot of the time. And, you know, he grows up basically to be that same kind of person where he's crashing on different other people's houses and he doesn't have a sense of home or what that means.
That's completely possible. I mean, it's how he was living, so I don't have any...
I'm not saying this to excuse him, Jim. Please don't think that I am. I'm just trying to sort of track its leakage. You know, even though they may be spinning this as a rosy tale, you can still see underneath that if this is true, that he was kind of a...
Well, he did have numerous homes. I mean, the Italian family did give him a home, and he was there for a number of years. And I think the girlfriend in Milan, they actually lived together. And I'd be really interested to hear her story. So he's, you know, and he did have a home with his father. But I agree with you. There were large chunks of time where he didn't have, you know, a nurturing adult in his life. But all these opportunities that he's given to try and adjust.
He can't
fit. And people
fit.
Investing
he
in
yeah,
him.
He can't, yeah.
Yeah, why is it? And that's, again, for me, why it plays back into some of the things that Jim was saying about... potential sort of mental health or, you know, personality disorder, the fact that he just cannot fit in, or even though he's given these incredible opportunities. And then, you know, they get to the issue around, you know, drugs. And she asks him very clearly, you know, did you take drugs? And he says, no, I didn't do any hard drugs. I would just, you know, sometimes have a joint. I wouldn't really drink. You know, I'm not sure whether I believe that
either. When he adds the word hard drugs and he adds really drink, to me,
he's qualifying alcohol.
Yes, it's clear that he knows that people can disprove those statements. He knows that other people were there when he did drugs and when he drank, so he had to qualify it. But the fact is that, you know, as we stated earlier, his behavior on this night where he killed Meredith Kircher shows that he made some bad decisions. And it could be that was aided by being under the influence of one or more substances.
And some people did refer to him as sort of the local drug dealer. You know, again, I don't know how much reliance we can put into some of those reports, but certainly, you know, one of the things that the police would do immediately that he comes into the equation of, you know, in the investigation is that you would timeline that person. So I wonder where he was, with these gaps where he just disappears in time. Where does he go and what's he doing? And, you know, how many times is he arrested by the police but not charged? And this is one of my big things around intelligence, because a lot of the times, having worked in intelligence, you know, the charge at some point, yes, you know, and you can see things on police national computer, depending on what system you have. But not every case results in a charge and a prosecution, but intelligence is collated. And I would be fascinated to know the intelligence profile of him, because it's something that in this interview he hangs like a badge, you know, saying, and it's in part three when he's asked about his background and breaking and entering, he says there was nothing there. There's nothing to see.
Yeah, and that's wonderful. He says that. They found nothing. They found nothing. That's what we call a protest rather than a denial. He didn't say, I was never arrested. I never committed a crime. He said they found nothing. And then within minutes after that, he says, well, they arrested me in Milan.
I was never charged.
Yeah, but he was arrested. They did find something. They did find his behavior. They did find him in a kindergarten overnight, eating their food, sleeping there, in possession of stolen property from another burglary just weeks before.
Yeah, but we'll get into that, how he describes that whole incident.
Yeah.
Well, let's discuss exactly what happened and his account when we come back.
Ecco, vorrei che lei facesse con noi un altro viaggio. Vorrei che lei ci portasse in Costa d'Avorio, nella sua terra lontana, per raccontarci di quel bambino strappato dal suo paese, strappato dalle braccia della mamma.
So let's talk about what happened 4 days before the murder on the 27th of October 2007 in Milan. Let's talk about his account, really Guedes, but also what we know happened. So we know that he was arrested for being in a kindergarten. And so should we start with his version of events, first of all, which was, you know, the fact that he said that he's never been charged for anything and that he was in a club in Milan and he got separated from his friends and then a South American man.
Just a general, generic person that nobody knows. Some South American man.
Well, it wasn't a South American to start with. It was just a man. And then she pressed him. And the next detail was a South American man.
Right.
Takes him to a kindergarten.
Yes, which we all do, right? But what's important, though, I think, is that it came right after, this story came right after he said, she questioned him about his purported criminal history, all these things about burglaries and thefts and all these horrible things and drugs and drug dealing. And he said that in this protest, he said, nothing was ever found. And then literally, like minutes later, he's detailing how he got arrested.
But he does caveat it with, he was never charged. So again, we've kind of got this movement from there was nothing to then Milan being brought up to then he was never charged.
But why and then was he never charged? We need to go into that as well. So
we certainly
do.
We certainly do. So, you know, he says that he's taken to this kindergarten and she asks him, well, you know, what do you mean a kindergarten, a school? And, you know, didn't you think that was odd? And he sort of says, no, you know, he said he would take people there. And she then says, well, how did you get in? And he says, well, he had a key. Mm-hmm. And then he basically says, you know, he wakes up and the police are there and it's all a big misunderstanding.
Yeah. Well, he says that it's his wife who works at the kindergarten, this mysterious
South American
right,
guy
who Rudy says that he shouldn't have trusted. He's somebody I met. I shouldn't have trusted. And he, you know, opened the door. He had a key. His wife works there.
But why does he not have a place to go home to? Just because he gets separated from his friends doesn't mean that he's homeless, right? Why is he not going back to the place where he was going to stay? It's a good question. It's a question that maybe the interviewer should have asked him. But, of course, she doesn't. Because the fact is, we know that he intentionally broke in there and stayed there because that's what he does. That's his MO. That's what he's used to doing.
Well, that's what my question was, because he says, you know, the owner arrives and there's a chain of misunderstandings. But so why doesn't he call the wife of this and have her explain why he's there? I mean,
if she worked there, why didn't she come into work and say, oh, yeah, my husband, the South American man, he let him in. Why didn't that happen? Because it was a lie.
Because he's very scant on any of the details. And unfortunately, the interviewer doesn't push him on any of these things. Her big ask was about how did you get in there?
Right.
Not about any of the detail, you know, of why you're not staying in your own place and why didn't you explain this to the police? But in terms of what he has in his possession, he says that he had a laptop that he bought from a flea market, as one does, buy a laptop from flea markets.
Right. A pre-owned laptop. Yes. Actually, a stolen laptop. That was stolen
from a lawyer.
From a lawyer's home office on the second floor after a rock had been thrown through the window. And then he climbed up through that window and took the laptop, two laptops, I believe, at that point. So he's found with stolen property and a knife. What's interesting about that is his story about the knife. Oh, well, see, that was all another big misunderstanding. It's funny how these misunderstandings keep snowballing here, but that his laptop, which he didn't steal, but that he bought at a flea market, was sitting on a table, and so was this knife. So the police just gathered it up and put it in his bag. Seconds later, he says, I don't know how that knife got in my bag. He just said that the police put it in his bag. Why does he now not know how it got in his bag? Because he hasn't gotten his lies straight. And, of course, she doesn't call him on these lies. They've never found anything of a criminal history of me being a burglar. And then seconds later, he's talking about the fact that he got arrested for breaking and entering and burglaring.
So he's caught in the lie.
Yes.
And in the blink of an eye, no one seems to notice that he's been caught in the lie, and therefore he's not credible in terms of what he's saying.
But if he's purchased stolen goods, like a laptop from a flea market, why isn't there, well, who sold it to you? What did they look like? Who is the actual, if you didn't steal this, then help us find the person who did. And that just seems to be glossed over.
Right, but
instead. Airbrushed out of the conversation.
Right. Instead, purportedly, the police in Milan get a call from the police in Perugia, and they say, put him on the next train back to Perugia. Why would they do that? Could be that his benefactor in Perugia has influence with the police. Could also be that maybe he was an asset of the police in Perugia. In my experience, cops don't go out of their way when somebody's arrested in another town for a crime to tell those police in the other town, don't throw him in jail. Send him back to us. We want him. Because that's usually a problem for the police, having somebody who's burglarized a kindergarten or a home or an office. So,
plus, wouldn't he flee? I mean, why would they trust that he would go back?
I don't know.
It's just
unsupervised, put him on a train, pay his fare. I mean, it's all very peculiar.
It's very
at the very
peculiar.
Least as to why that would happen. And certainly, you know, the next cut on that interview is a teacher talking about him saying, I've known him for 7 years and he had no criminal record. So he hangs back to the kind of no criminal record again.
No criminal record? If you've known him for 7 years, then you know that he was convicted of murdering Meredith Kircher. Why is that no criminal record? I just don't understand that statement. He's convicted of burglarizing. He's convicted of murder. He's convicted of sexual assault. Why is that not a criminal record? That sounds to me like bending over backwards to justify the behavior of a criminal because they have formed a bond or an attachment to that person.
And even he explains it away, you see, and I think this is part of, you know, his manipulation. He explains it away in his own admission. He says, I was careless with the laptop, but I still waited for the police. You know, I'm not a misfit. I'm a responsible sort of citizen. This is, you know, the way that he threads it throughout this interview, that he has an explanation for everything. I think it much more talks to naivety and manipulation than anything else, because, you know, we can see him the way he presents, which is wholly believable and plausible unless you check the facts of the case.
Yeah.
And if you check the facts, then it's...
This is something that we, of course, do when we're doing an investigative interview or an interrogation, which is drill down into the details. Mm-hmm. Because most people lie in layers. They have a generalized overstory and some layers of detail underneath, but not all the layers. And it's how you determine whether somebody's lying by following up with questions. And certainly journalists do it all the time, real journalists, not people like that goofball.
Who say, well, what do you expect me to do? Check and corroborate the facts?
Why would you want to do that?
Why would you do that? Mm. But I think, you know, we're talking about lying because I think it's an interesting thing that, you know, the kernel of truth that can be the start point and then the lie that sort of comes out of it. So I think there's some things threaded here which on the face of it look, you know, pretty plausible, and probably there's a kernel of truth in the things that he says, right. But then these kind of the web that appears around it. And he certainly, you know, tries to present as, you know, I'm not this misfit. And of course, everything we're seeing in this interview, he looks intellectually and culturally polished. And so, you know, any teacher, anyone coming into contact with him would, if they are not of sort of our background, Jim C., who tests everything out and follows up with certain questions or gaps or areas that don't seem to make sense, or, you know, omissions or accounts that don't have nuanced detail within them, you know, that are broad brush, then you could very well fall foul of being drawn in.
Yeah, just by accepting the word of Guede about this South American man, just by leaving it that and not asking any details and not asking about the wife who worked there and not asking why he didn't prepare him for what would happen in the morning when the staff came in. None of those questions were asked. They all should be able to be answered by Guede, but unfortunately, she never even asked them.
Yeah, but also, and where did he get the money for this computer? I mean, so far, I haven't heard that he's actually been employed very many places, or have we?
He keeps losing his job.
Well, he was a bartender in Milan, but of course, we don't know why he lost that job. It always makes it sound as if things are being done to him, not he is active and, you know, taking responsibility for those
things.
And
where do we see that? What kind of people do we see that in? I mean, you know, there are...
Taking responsibility for your own actions and...
No, people who don't, and people who always point the finger outside, and people who always blame other people for what they do. I mean,
you certainly say it with psychopathy,
yes,
and, you know,
do.
In...
Absolutely. And we'll when we get to the end of this, we'll have to put together all the different characteristics that we see in Guede and see where that all falls out.
So we then move to part four, where he now starts, she's asking him about how he meets Meredith and Amanda, and he sort of situates it that he met the boys at the house who were living on the bottom floor in early October, and he meets Amanda Knox at the beginning of September at the club Le Chic. And he already sort of situates it that he had spoken to Amanda, and he says a little bit in Italian. And he then meets Meredith Kircher at a rugby game, and then again on Halloween on October the 30th. And this is where things start to become very interesting in terms of his accounts.
Well, it's very clear, and I think this interviewer, Franca, actually sort of either suggests it. I don't know if he said it first, but she definitely suggests that he was rather smitten with Amanda, that he really wanted Amanda and not Meredith.
Yeah, I noticed that. She just jumps right in there with, you were really in love with her. What?
Right.
Based on
what? Based on the fact that they already did an interview, that this was all rehearsed,
right.
And this came out like this was leakage. She didn't realize that wasn't something he brought up. It's certainly not something I saw. Now, maybe I missed it earlier, but I didn't see any indication out of his mouth that he was actually smitten with Amanda, but she says it.
Well, they do get onto that, but he says that he first kissed Meredith Kircher in the Domus pub, and that she then says, well, that wasn't confirmed by the investigators.
Or her friends, right?
Or her friends, and that's another really important point, because, in fact, a friend, Sophie Parton, actually said that did not happen.
Right.
And his version after that was very interesting.
It was.
Go on, you say you saw.
What he says is that, well, I find it hard to believe that Sophie could have kept track of her the whole night, because there's so much chaos in the club and the lights were dim. So basically, he's doing exactly the same thing. It's another protest. It's not. He's not saying, look.
Well, it just happened.
I kissed her.
Yeah, we kissed each other. That's it. That's all there is to it. Instead,
he's
saying,
He's looking at the other person's perspective and trying to undermine their perspective. Well, how could they know? How could they really know? How could they really have kept track with her?
Because girlfriends do. Girlfriends are very aware of who you're talking to,
especially
who bought you a drink, and who you're
somebody that you just met, right? Yeah. If you're out with your girlfriend, and somebody tries to pick her up, or she's talking to somebody, the friends usually do pay attention. They're aware of the fact that that's risky, and
or you'd at least talk about it. Yes. She'd come back and say, "Oh, I just met this guy." Da, da, da,
girlfriends,
you know,
talk. I mean, absolutely. And he just sort of plays that down by saying, "Oh, we're young people. We kiss each other all the time, just in clubs." And what we know about Meredith's baseline behavior is that's not who she was. That's right. Not who her friends describe her as being. It's not how her first relationship came to pass. And I don't think there would have been, you know, a rapid departure. No. From the girl that everybody seemed to know and love,
right,
to why she starts behaving in this way. But I think it's very interesting the way that he couches it, of sowing that seed and sort of undermining and giving trying to throw out this kind of plausibility rather than just saying it just happened. There's nothing more to it than that.
Right.
And he said the boys didn't know it was happening either. She would then come and watch him play basketball. No one knew about that. And this is the
Everything
point where
secret.
He gets quite animated.
Right.
Yeah.
And he starts talking over her. There's no more bashfulness. He's not coy. He's not shy about it.
He's
actually
bragging.
Yeah, pretty robust in his reply.
And this is like what you just said, Laura, something about that the best lies have a kernel of truth. And this is what it sounds like to me. Like, there is enough truth. He set up enough truths that have been testified by other people that, yeah, they may have met each other in passing and this and that. And then he starts to weave in his version of things, and it becomes hard to tease that out and unentangle
right.
it.
The layers.
Yeah, it's called a lie of omission rather than commission, where you omit the negative parts and you fill in places that actually help you. But it's what he's doing with this kiss lie is he's laying the foundation for his ultimate lie, which is that he was invited in that house by Meredith for romantic reasons and that somebody else came in. I mean, it's just, when we get to that, I mean, if it weren't murder, it would be laughable. It would be absurdly laughable what his defense is here. It is absurd, but the fact is it's deadly absurd. And we'll get into that a little bit, but when he lays this foundation of the kiss, he's doing two things. One is he's boosting up his own ego about how this attractive young lady would be attracted to him, of course. And, you know, of course she would just want to kiss me. And of course she would then do what young people do, which is invite me over her house the very next day. And of course she wanted to be with me. And of course we started engaging in sexual activity because we were in a good mood. You know, all that kind of crap. To me, it's all of the same ilk. It's all a lie upon a lie upon a lie. And unfortunately, well, this interviewer certainly didn't drill down and ask details, but it's very convenient that nobody in this entire club ever came forward to say that they saw them kissing. Nobody in this entire town came forward to say that she came by to watch him play basketball. Nobody in this entire town came by to say that he and she were having this romantic thing, period. And then it's twisted with this, I don't know where she gets it, but Franca comes up with this whole thing that he was really attracted to Amanda.
Mm.
And that it was some kind of bizarre, maybe, motivation for his pointing the finger at Amanda, that Amanda was jealous that he was with Meredith instead of with Amanda.
Yeah, and I think, you know, going back to what you said, you know, no one seeing them together, and of course Meredith was actually dating somebody else,
right?
But there was no telephone analysis that supported how did they organise this meeting. You know, there's just so many problems with it. And even when they talk about the murder, he calls it that sad event. So
right.
We see the distancing. So he says that he has a date with Meredith Kircher that night, mm-hmm. and when he's talking about this, he actually has a little glint in his eye.
Mm.
And I think that part, again, is quite interesting because you compare it and contrast it to this sort of bashful, kind of being quite coy and candid when he's asked about catching girls. And now he's saying, Well, no, I knew her birthday would be in December because I always go for December women. I always date December women.
Yeah, but he also, when she talks about Amanda, he also says that he and she were kind of talking to each other. And she said, but she was dating Raffaele. And he said, no. I come to find out that she was only dating him for 5 days before the sad event,
the sad
right?
event.
Right. And so at that time, she was free. So, of course, she'd be attracted to me. Again, he's trying to sell himself as a ladies' man. He's trying to boost his ego. I mean, it's really just so obvious that what he's really trying to do here and this whole interview is really an image-boosting mechanism. And he's manipulating us and to the point where he's trying to say that because Amanda was not seeing Raffaele, she must have been interested in him. Meanwhile, it was a passing, momentary
She was
meeting.
Probably just asking him for what he wants to drink, given
right.
her job and her role there. I mean, that's how I kind of interpreted
right,
it.
Right,
he was
right.
trying to make it something much more than what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Because for her, she has no real, you know, her account is that he wasn't somebody that was on her radar at all.
No, she knew lots of people. She had lots of friends who come in and out of her bar, certainly.
Yeah, and when you're waiting on people or serving them in a busy bar. But I think, you know, just in that part in particular, there's lots of inconsistent statements. And again, you know, Franca has all these opportunities to really drill down into the detail.
And she doesn't.
And she doesn't. And I still got this impression that what you're seeing on the surface for Guede is very different to what's going on underneath.
Right. And he calls himself, again, along that same kind of thing where he's trying to project an image. He calls himself a student, a boy at 20 years. I mean, you know, he's really, really trying to oversell this. And when we see that overselling kind of thing, when it's absurd like this, it just tends to prove the opposite. I mean, he knows he was a man, a young man.
How many 20-year-olds would refer to themselves as boy? I mean, guys want to be known as men. They don't want to be known as boys. So this is just a complete reversal with intention.
Right. And if he was 20 then, he's 29 now. He's still in his 20s. So to say
I
that
I think he's just turned 30, but there's a lot of manipulation in
right,
what he
but
says.
But he's just, you know, trying to make us feel like he's that little boy that got ripped away from his mommy, and
he takes us back there.
It's pure manipulation.
Yeah, the levels and you know, the levels of manipulation are very high and. You know, anyone not really understanding that would do so at their own peril with him, as you quite rightly said. And I think part five then gets into, you know, as I put here, there's a major problem again with the stance and the tone and the questioning of the interviewer, who makes sort of what I call fanciful statements of, you know, asking about him and how he, you know, he gains entry to the property. And he says, well, she says, well, they have, you know, you people are saying that you climb the wall like a gecko. And she kind of actions out being a gecko or like a Spider-Man, you know, to get into that villa. And, of course, the villa isn't even rich. There's not a lot of money there. And that's how she opens up that.
That has nothing to do with anything.
Yeah, I mean, so how many millions of dollars would you expect to find in a kindergarten? I mean, you know, that's not his MO. He doesn't break into villas. He breaks into small-time places. He steals little things, computers and cell phones and $300. I mean, she's justifying his behavior and climbing up like a gecko. No, a gecko doesn't need a window with bars on it below the target window. A gecko can walk up a wall. It can certainly be done by somebody young and athletic like Guede. It was done by Raffaele's
attorney.
Who's older and not young and agile.
Right.
And what's interesting is Guede then mirrors her. And he does the kind of climbing up the wall. So there's mirroring when it suits him.
Right.
And then she sort of throws in, or you break him for a sex game party. And she kind of sort of shrugs it off as if this is just so fanciful and so ridiculous. So we've still got so much more to discuss. And I think in our next pod, we need to really start to get into the detail of his version of events, of how he says he got in. And then what happened in terms of, you know, the behaviours, the interaction, and what went on between him and Meredith inside the villa.
Yeah, and we should also cover the different statements that he's made from the first time he made a recorded statement till the last time he made a recorded statement about this same stuff.
So if listeners want to follow along, again, we'll have this interview posted on Facebook, on our Facebook page. So far we've gone from, it's in chunks. So if you've gone through part one, we're about halfway through part five if you want to follow along to where we are right now.
So it's Royal Crime Profile signing off for now. Thank you. So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214 946 4357 or go on their website www.genesisshelter.org or the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.
If you're a regular listener to the show, you know we have great brands like Blue Apron, Audible, and Casper advertising with us, and they keep coming back because our listeners really respond to them, which we're really thankful for. Well, if you happen to own a business or manage the advertising buy for one, then you should consider advertising on Real Crime Profile. Podcast advertising is on the rise, and it's one of the most effective ways of reaching consumers on the go today. So please go to Wondery.com/advertisers. Again, it's Wondery.com/advertisers. And get in touch with us. Thanks.